President Biden's approval on gun policy drops below 30%. Plus, bearing arms Cam Edwards on Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin wiping out a slate of gun control bills. That and more on this episode of the Weekly Reload Podcast.
No, the devil's got no hold on me.
Ooh. Ooh. All right, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Weekly Reload Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Gutowski. I'm also the CNN contributor and the founder of TheReload.com, where you can head over and sign up for a free newsletter today if you want to keep up to date with what's going on with guns in America. You can also, of course, buy a membership if you want to get exclusive access to hundreds of pieces of analysis that you will not find anywhere else. This week, we are going to be talking about Virginia, my home state, where I live now, and where we're sort of at the epicenter of, I think, gun policy in America, where things are headed. I think Virginia right now speaks to some really interesting trends. And in order to talk about those trends and what's going on, I have a fellow Virginian with me this week, another gun writer, somebody who's been following this intently, Cam Edwards from Bearing Arms, the editor over there. Welcome to the show, Cam.
Hey, Steve, it's good to be back.
Yeah, thank you for coming back. Always one of my favorite guests to have on. I think we follow a lot of the same stuff, and I always appreciate your insight into where things are at and where they're headed. So I appreciate you doing this.
Absolutely. We are big fans of The Reload over at Bearing Arms. In fact, my colleague Tom Knighton was just covering your take on the poll showing Biden's low approval numbers on guns. So, yeah, great, great stuff from The Reload each and every day.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Same here. I'm always retweeting your guys' story. So obviously anybody listening, I think, would get a lot out of visiting Bearing Arms and listening to your show as well, which I often come on to.
Exactly. We need to, in fact, you know, I need to have you back on. I was thinking just yesterday, I need to send Steve an email and get that request going so we can get you on the show again.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love it. But why don't you give us a quick overview of what's happened here in Virginia? There's been some pretty significant developments just this week out of the governor's mansion here in Virginia.
Yeah, so Governor Youngkin, you know, he played this pretty close to the ever-present vest over the course of the session, right? He was asked numerous occasions, what are you going to do with all these bills that the Democrats are advancing? And his spokesperson said, well, you know, the governor said during the State of the State address that Virginia has some of the toughest gun laws in the country, but we'll take a look at, you know, these bills as they get here. So the governor ended up vetoing 30 bills, according to his office. Now, some of these are kind of duplicates, you know, same House and Senate version, but different bill numbers. He amended six of them. Virginia's kind of a unique animal in terms of, you know, what the powers of the governor are. So he can take a bill and say, you know what, I will sign it if you make these changes, and he'll send it back to the legislature. If the legislature makes those changes, then the bill becomes law. If they don't make those changes, then the bill is defeated. He did that with a half dozen bills, and then he signed two of the, I'd say, the most uncontroversial bills that were adopted by Democrats. These were bills that I think had at least a handful of Republican supporters as well.
Right. And so it was a lot of activity, right? I mean, that's one of the big takeaways, I think, in a state like Virginia, where we've got a Republican governor and we have Democrats in control of both houses of the state house of the legislature, but only by the thinnest of margins. Mm-hmm. It is interesting to see how much, one, action there has been on this issue. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the fact, even if we're talking about, you know, House and Senate versions of the same bill, we're talking about more than a dozen, right? Probably a dozen and a half substantive gun control measures, everything from waiting periods to, you know, changes to the red flag laws to bans on so-called assault weapons. Those were all sent to Governor Youngkin's desk. And then you look at states like New Mexico, where, you know, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham had a very expansive gun control agenda, right? She wanted a 14 business day waiting period. She wanted all kinds of new gun-free zones. And I think the Democrat majority in Santa Fe gave her two gun bills. They right. gave her a 7-day waiting period with concealed carry holders exempt. They banned open carry of firearms around polling places, but again, concealed carry holders were exempt. You can look at what Jay Inslee signed into law in Washington State this week. Again, just two or three bills, all of them sort of watered down. Even in Colorado, where they're, you know, advancing sensitive places bills. They are prepared to bring a quote unquote assaultments ban to the floor of the House. All of those measures have been heavily amended and I would say watered down, right? Scaled back substantially. We didn't see that in Virginia. There were, you know, maybe some minor tweaks to these gun bills, but they were adopted largely along party lines and in their, you know, high test form, right? These are the types of bills that you see pass in Sacramento and in Albany and in Boston and in Annapolis, not the type of bills that generally go anywhere in Virginia. And again, even more expansive and more intrusive than what we've seen in a lot of states that are Democrat controlled this year.
Yeah. And you know, to me, I don't know that we've seen any state that's been this active on the issue too. Like, you know, there's interesting points to pull here from what the legislation was and how far it went. And then also just the sheer volume of it. I don't even think California has passed this many pieces of gun legislation through their legislature. Now, ultimately, you're not going to have that end effect. And this is one of the reasons we haven't covered it as closely here at the Reload, I think, is because it's, you know, I think everyone, it wasn't clear, like you said, Youngkin wasn't out there talking a lot about it, but the sources that I'd spoken with and his office had given out the position that you mentioned earlier, but the sources I'd spoke with thought it's probably he's going to veto most of these, if not all of them. And so in the end of it, not much is going to change for Virginians on gun laws. So that's, you know, the practical side is not a huge difference there. But I really think the political side of this is what fascinates me, right? Because, you know, you have so much volume, so many gun bills after Democrats, you know, they had a slightly better than expected election in the, you know, in 2023, not, you know, they retook control of the legislature by thin margins. People thought
one
maybe
vote in each chamber. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the other remarkable thing about all this is like the Democrats stayed together so well on these issues. And you didn't have dissenters on any of them. That's one of the remarkable things to me is like, it's not just that you got a couple of gun bills through. It's that they got all of them through, all on almost exclusively party line, which meant they couldn't lose a single person in either chamber. And they didn't, even on some of the most aggressive bills that you mentioned, the assault weapons ban. They've got, waiting periods. They've made all kinds of changes to the concealed carry policies in Virginia. They would have made it much harder to get a permit because they removed a number of ways you can satisfy the training requirements, including getting rid of NRA and USCCA certification as an option, taking those classes. They would have eliminated a lot of the reciprocity deals that Virginia has with other states, which would have made the permit a lot less useful. So these are like practical negative things for a lot of people in Virginia, presumably including some of the constituents for some of these Democrats in more moderate areas. And so it's, what do you make of that? It's kind of fascinating.
It is fascinating. It's also somewhat terrifying as a Virginia gun owner, right? To know that I think of the truth about guns at a store today called the thin red line in Virginia. You know, again, Governor Youngkin is the sole backstop right now, right? Preventing these things from being enacted into law. And, you know, you compare this to just a couple of years ago, right? When Democrats took control of the state legislature, they had the governorship in 2019, right, in the November 2019 election. So 2020 comes around just before, you know, COVID hits and disrupts everything.
It was like the last big political story before
really was, right? And that was when, you know, we started hearing, okay, we're going to run a assault weapon ban. And Northam's talking about confiscation, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to be allowed to possess the guns that you currently have. That was when we saw in January of 2020, somewhere between 30 and 50,000 gun owners show up in downtown Richmond for the VCDL Lobby Day rally. Just thronged downtown Richmond in a show of force, saying, listen, we're not going to stand for this. We object to this.
And that was after that very successful Second Amendment sanctuary movement that where you saw.
I think it was in the midst of it. Yeah, I think it was still going on at that point. That by the time the rally took place, probably the bulk of the counties and cities in Virginia that adopted those resolutions had done so. But I think there were still, some meetings that were taking place. But yeah, I mean, I was covering those events and those meetings in December, early January, and then the rally took place, I think, mid-January, because I went from the rally to the airport to go out to SHOT Show. I remember that was sort of the timing of it. But, you know, even then, just a few years ago, you had Democrats like Senator Craig Deeds, who were the primary roadblock to Democrats passing that gun ban. He said at the time, he wasn't necessarily opposed to the idea of banning guns in theory, right? But he didn't like that bill. Well, he sure liked this year's bill because he signed on as a co-sponsor. And as you say, you know, Deeds, who represented a fairly rural part of Virginia, he got redistricted and ended up moving to Charlottesville and ran for re-election in a very safe blue district. And because of that, he doesn't have to worry about representing rural gun owners anymore, right? Yeah, I think there are still plenty of gun owners in Charlottesville who he should keep in mind. But now Deeds is now just a, you know, cut and dried standard anti-gun Democrat. And as you say, that is the case for the entirety of the caucus. There are no, you know, blue dog Democrats in Virginia in the legislature, at least when it comes to guns. They are in lockstep. And they're, you know, they're in line with the Kathy Hochuls of the world, the Gavin Newsoms of the world, some of the most, ardent gun control supporters. And you're right. I think it is interesting to I wonder if that would change if there was a Democratic governor. Would they still have gone as aggressively as they did? Or was some of this, you know, sort of political performance art, right? Knowing, OK, well, I can vote for this and I don't actually have to live with the consequences because I'm pretty sure Youngkin's going to veto it. That might have, you know, been on the minds of some of these lawmakers. But I mean, I'll say as a gun owner of Virginia, I can't count on that to be the case. Right. We only have their votes to go on. That's their record. And what the record shows this year is that there are no moderates when it comes to gun control on the left side of the aisle in Richmond.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to look at it any other way in terms of where they've all, I mean, it wasn't like you had five or six bills that were a little more moderate that got all Democrats on board and got through. Every single one of these had every Democrat on board. And they're all, many of them, not all of them necessarily, but many of them are some of the most restrictive policies that you could imagine. And that's one of the fascinating things about it. And I do think you're right that there's something at play when the opposition party has the final say over whether something's going to become law. You're maybe a little bit more willing to vote on things that you don't think you'll actually have to answer for it in the form of, people being affected by the law. So that probably has some effect here, but at the same time, and I do, I think there's also sort of been a very successful to this point campaign from gun control advocates to reshape the Democratic Party in Virginia, and I'm sure the Democratic Party at large, obviously, but very much so here in Virginia. They've spent a lot of money in a lot of these local races over the years, really unprecedented amounts of money over the years. I think that part of it is, the NRA is based here. I think people know now from this whole legal fight, they're technically legally based in New York, but their actual office is here in Virginia. And so that takes on a symbolic quality, it seems, for a lot of these gun control groups. They want to beat the NRA in its backyard is a common theme you'll hear. And, it seems like that's had a pretty real effect. Like they've managed to get Democrats on board with everything they want to do. And you're seeing that now here.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, in the campaign last year, and I know you've talked about this on the podcast and at the Reload before, gun control groups like Everytown weren't even necessarily making gun control their big issue, right? During the campaigns, it was abortion. That was it. And every town's cutting ads about, you know, candidate A will protect your right to an abortion. And, oh, yeah, she'll go after guns, too. You know, gun control was almost an afterthought. But then once we get into the session, gun control is very much, I would say, the top priority for Democrats. You know, I mean, they tried to pass a bill that would legalize retail sales of marijuana. You know, I know that they've tried to do some stuff on abortion, but I think when you tally up, you know, all of the bills, you'd probably find that there were more gun bills advancing and getting to Governor Youngkin's desk than any other topic or any other subject.
And I think you're right, actually, on the importance of it. There was this was actually one of the political pawns or one of the pieces that Democratic leadership tried to use in the stadium fight. This was Youngkin. One of his big initiatives the last year or so was trying to get the D.C. Hockey and basketball teams to move to Virginia, to Alexandria. He had a whole stadium deal he was going to do, and it fell apart because there was opposition from Democrats in the state house. And one of the things they were trying to extract from him in exchange for the stadium deal, it didn't work clearly because the stadium deal is dead and Youngkin has vetoed all these bills, but they wanted the gun bills as part of that.
Yeah, you're right. The gun bills, they wanted the marijuana legalization. Like they were trying to do some, I don't know if I'd call it horse trading as much as maybe holding the arena deal hostage might be a better way to describe it, you know. And I have to say, personally, as a Virginian who no longer lives in Northern Virginia, I'm okay with that arena deal collapsing because I wasn't a huge fan of it to begin with. I don't really like the idea of public financing stadiums. I think if billionaires want to move their team somewhere, cool, you got the money to pay for it. But I digress. You know, and you're right. It wasn't successful. And I'm glad that Youngkin didn't take the bait. What that tells me is that Youngkin is interested in further political office in Virginia. And he was not willing to make that trade. If Youngkin really was just going to be a one and done governor, kind of, you know, disappear and go back to the world of business. Maybe he does have some sincerely held beliefs about the Second Amendment. And he found these bills to be personally repugnant and wasn't going to sign them anyway. That was just a line in the sand. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, the fact that he rejected all of these bills, he didn't play footsie with the Democrats and say, well, what if I sign this one over here and maybe, you know, veto those? Would that be acceptable to you? Doesn't sound like any of that took place. And that indicates to me that Youngkin is trying to figure out, OK, maybe challenge Mark Warner for a U.S. Senate seat in 2026. I think Warner's up in 26. But, you know, I don't think we've seen the last of Glenn Youngkin, even though his term in office is going to be done here pretty soon.
Yeah, that's the other side of this. You know, obviously, we just went over the Democrats and where they're at politically and what this says about the Democratic Party in Virginia and perhaps we'll get into what it says beyond Virginia in a little bit in a moment here. But I think, yeah, looking at it from the Youngkin standpoint, because he didn't campaign in any meaningful sense on guns, right? This wasn't a top priority successful attempt to become governor. Virginia is weird in that it has a one term limit. Now you can run again. You can't have consecutive terms in Virginia. So he could run for governor again at some point in the future. That hasn't really worked out for people in the past. In fact, that's how he got in, is beating the guy who tried to run again. But he could try to become senator. It does feel like a move for somebody who's looking towards the future in the Republican Party at this point, because the other side of this is it'd be one thing if you had all the Democrats on board with all these bills, and then you had a number of Republicans come over to support a bunch of them or some of them. And you could say, well, maybe Virginia is just moving in that direction politically towards stricter gun laws, towards, you know, broader support for stricter gun laws. And that's why you're seeing this uniformity on the Democratic side, but you know, there was a pretty solid uniformity on the Republican side as well. You really didn't, no one crossed over for the assault weapons ban or some of the more restrictive laws on concealed carry or any number of these other bills. There was one senator, I believe, who voted for a couple of these, one Republican senator, right? Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
Yeah, and I think this was, I cannot remember the senator's name, but I think she represents a Richmond suburb district, Henrico County, yeah. Maybe that part of the state. And, you know, I think this speaks to, again, some of the work that gun control activists have been doing over the past couple of years. They have really targeted female voters. You know, to the point that you can look at polling and there's a pretty stark divide between, you know, when you ask, do we have enough gun laws on the books? Do we need more gun laws? What do you think about a particular gun control policy? More women are going to say, I like that gun control law. More men are going to say, I'm opposed to it. And I think the gun control groups have, in part, helped spur that along. But I think they've also recognized that trend. And so they are courting female voters and female politicians. And saying, you know, this is the common sense route to take. What the only thing that really troubles me about that is that, you know, we have very few true swing districts in Virginia. Most of the legislative seats are safe. And the Democrat candidate in a blue district is going to win by 40 or 50 points. The Republican candidate in a red district is going to win by about the same margin. So we're really only talking about maybe a half dozen or so districts where, you know, the control of the legislature is really a play. And I think it's incumbent on us to ensure that we've got good Second Amendment candidates. Listen, I'd love to see a race where I don't know who to vote for because both the Republican and the Democrat are really good on my issue. Right. That hasn't happened. And in fact, as you say, we've sort of seen a little bit of a break towards the other side where now you've got a Republican senator who says, well, I can support some of these gun control bills, maybe not all of them, but I can support some of them. So, you know, I think from
it was pretty uniform, right? Other than that,
it really was. Senator. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of 21-19 votes in the Senate, right? A lot of 51-49 votes in the House with every Democrat in support and every Republican opposed. And generally speaking, I think that one
Republican was not voting for the most controversial of these gun measures.
No, a lot of them, I think, were, you know, bills to, you know, to use the school system to, you know, send gun safety messages to parents. Things about, you know, not allowing minors access to a firearm. But I don't think she voted in favor of the gun ban bill or the waiting periods or anything of that sort.
No. So we had a pretty stark divide on this, just down the line on most of the vast majority of these bills. And, you know, another thing that I'm that I wonder out of that is like, do you think that speaks to where we are nationwide as well? Do you think this is just a Virginia issue? You mentioned obviously there's the sort of gerrymandering effect that's at play in Virginia, where there's not a lot of swing districts anymore. Even if that's not a result of gerrymandering, there's just not a lot of swing districts in Virginia. But I mean, there's not that many swing districts, swing states out there in the country anymore. And it feels like this is what where Virginia is kind of a microcosm of the rest of the country. Does that fit with your view as well?
It does. Particularly again, when you talk about just sort of that 50-50 divide, right? I think that we are roughly a 50-50 nation. And you know, obviously that depends on what state you look at. You've got states that tilt heavily to the right and heavily to the left, but generally speaking, on so many issues, yeah, I think this is, you know, a deeply divided and narrowly divided country. And I think that that's the case on Second Amendment issues, which is, you know, again, it's one of the reasons why I don't want to see, and it's tough because, again, the Democrats are marching in lockstep against our Second Amendment rights in so many cases. But I think it would behoove us as gun owners and as Second Amendment advocates to start encouraging that pro-gun Democrat, right? So that we don't have all of our eggs in one basket, because again, you get yourself in a position where all of a sudden now you've got one person who's the fail-safe, one person who is, you know, able to prevent a lot of these bills from becoming laws. So, you know, I'm looking around and I'm trying to figure out how can we encourage. We know more Democrats are becoming gun owners, right? We know that coalition of gun owners is broadening. How do we convince some of those folks to now start running for office and to support our right to keep and bear arms so that, again, maybe one day we have the opportunity to vote for two really good candidates on our issue in these swing districts?
Yeah, I mean, I think you bring up an interesting point is the potential for breaking this sort of stalemate that's formed, this polarization, does seem to be in these new gun owners that we've talked a lot about over the last 4 years, right? Who tend to be, you know, minorities, women, people from more rural, from more urban areas, you know, those demographics are buying guns at a higher rate than they previously did. Now, they also happen to be demographics that traditionally vote more for Democrats. Now, you know, we're talking about broad strokes here. Obviously, individuals are complex people, and we're just talking about big groups, and people have their own agency inside of that. But the theory is that if you're going to start seeing change from these new gun owners and downstream in the political realm, that it'll probably be in places like Democratic primaries, where maybe they don't change their opinion on all sorts of different issues, but on this issue, you might get more pro-gun Democrats. Is that one? Do you think that is the way that this could break out, this sort of stalemate that the country has gotten into? And two, do you see any actual practical signs of it? Because it's something we've talked a lot about, but is it actually happening?
The practical signs are few and far between, unfortunately. You know, I think that there's one individual who's running for state representative in Montana, as a Democrat, Stuart Rhodeson from Oath Keepers. He has renounced his dad's political views, and he's running as a Democrat, but he says he doesn't believe that gun control laws do anything. And so he's not running as a pro-gun control Democrat. But outside of him, honestly, I would struggle to find, a lot of other Democrats who have embraced that point of view as a candidate. And I think that you're right. I think a lot of this will come in the Democratic primary, because a lot of these seats that we're talking about, again, these safe blue seats, you might not even have a Republican running, right? There might not be another option. In Northern Virginia, Arlington, Fairfax County, unfortunately, I think those places are lost to the GOP right now. Particularly the closer you get to D.C. I mean, Arlington, Alexandria, you're looking at 85% Democrat vote in a general election. So it's going to have to be in the primary where those changes are made and where there is a pro Second Amendment option. Right. And it may be somebody like Josh Stein. He's running for governor in North Carolina. He's the Democrat attorney general right now. I wrote about this at Bearing Arms this week. He was at Duke University. He's talking to student journalists and he says, I'm fighting for your fundamental freedoms. And then he lists abortion and he lists, I think it was voting rights. And then he starts talking about all the gun control ideas that he has. Right. So obviously not those aren't one of the fundamental freedoms that he's actually fighting for. And I think what you could see is a Democrat who says, I'm fighting for your fundamental freedoms, your right to reproductive freedom, your right to vote, and your right to own a firearm, for personal defense. And it may be that that Democrat is not a 100% A-rated NRA candidate, right? That even that Democrat says, I don't believe in gun-free zones, or I don't think we should have all these sensitive places. Don't believe we should have these, really restrictive licensing laws. But boy, I don't really like those large capacity magazines. I don't know what anybody needs an AR-15. I think that's what we're really likely to see at first, is not necessarily somebody, the switch flipping. All of a sudden, they go from completely anti-gun to completely pro-gun, but starting to kind of chip away at that, wall of resistance to our Second Amendment rights, where you'll find Democrats saying, okay, this goes too far for me, that goes too far for me, but this gun control bill I'm okay with.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it's interesting because, bringing it back to Virginia for a moment, you had the sponsor of the assault weapons ban from 2020, Delegate Levine, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, he became a pretty big touch point for that legislation. He got a lot of attention for it, and he was very passionate in arguing for it. He was out of Alexandria, which is a pretty deep blue area in Virginia. And he lost his primary after that to somebody who was not necessarily, wasn't pro-gun by any means. I don't think anyone would label his opponent that, but she was much less aggressive on the issue. But at the same time, you look at now, fast forward to today, and obviously she voted for all of these bills. So I don't know. Is that, I'm guessing you want to see a lot more than just being like a little bit less aggressive on the issue, but still voting for these bans, to start to really buy into the idea that this change is going to occur.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Again, there were a lot of Democrat candidates last year who didn't make gun control either a top issue or an issue at all. And instead, they focused on things like abortion. Right. Because I think the Dobbs decision just sucked a lot of air out of the room. And that was something the Democrats really felt like they could run strong on. Look, it's the Republicans trying to ban something that, a lot of folks like. It's not us this time around. It's not enough for them to deprioritize gun control. If they're still going to vote for it when the party brings these bills forward. Right. You need to have those candidates who can. And I think that there is a progressive case against the Second Amendment. If you are opposed to, mass incarceration, if you're opposed to over-policing.
Against gun control.
Right. Absolutely. How do these laws get enforced? In fact, this is something that Colorado Democrats are kind of wrestling with this year because, there are a lot of lefty Democrats, far left Democrats in Colorado who aren't in favor of expanding, the police state. But they do love themselves some gun control. So like the, so-called Sobeys ban that was introduced in Colorado originally didn't have any jail time attached to it. If you were, caught violating that law, I think it was a $250,000 fine. They'll bankrupt you, right? But they're not going to put you in jail. And then they decide, maybe even that's too much. So they, the current bill, I think, makes it a petty offense to violate the assault weapons ban, right? So $500 fine, maybe 6 months in jail. It's the lowest level offense in Colorado's criminal code. And that poses its own problems for Democrats, right? Because now, okay, so what's the point? You say these things are serious problems, you say these things are serious issues, and yet there are no serious consequences for violating these laws in your bill. So why put this bill in place? There's got to be another way, right, to reduce violent crime. There's got to be another way to stop these types of active assailant attacks. And I think that provides an opening for Republicans and pro-gun Democrats alike to say, look, these things are kind of a joke at this point. Let's get serious about these issues and let's offer a serious and substantive proposal to address these concerns.
Okay. And so for you, then at this point, you're not giving up on the idea that this sort of change is going to happen or could happen down the line here.
I mean, I'm not giving up, but you know what? I buy Powerball tickets too. So I'm not saying I expect it to happen, that I expect this change to occur. Right. I'm an eternal optimist. And I'd love to see it happen. Where I'm struggling right now is how to encourage this, right? Mm. How to help get that ball rolling. And I don't have a good answer for that. I wish I did.
Mm. All right. Well, so what do you take from all of this, this flood of bills and the responding vetoes for the future of Virginia gun politics in particular?
The biggest thing that I take away is with a governor's race coming up next year, Republicans, have to get a candidate who speaks to more Virginians, as many Virginians as possible. And that was something that Youngkin did very well. I complained when Youngkin was on the campaign trail. He's not talking enough about guns. Well, he won, right? And so maybe he didn't need to talk as much about guns. Glenn Youngkin's approval rating is, I think, 57, 58% in Virginia right now. That's extraordinarily well for a politician in a state that, has been trending blue for a couple of decades. So if we could try to find somebody, who can replicate Youngkin's campaign style and the way he was able to resonate with Virginians, talking about education issues, talking about families, I think that's hugely important. And it may mean that even though my most important issue is maybe, fourth or fifth or sixth on the candidate's list of important issues, again, it's kind of like what the Democrats did in 2023, right? They ran on abortion and then they pivoted to gun control. Well, I guess I don't really mind a Republican candidate who is talking less about, standing up for the Second Amendment as long as they do the right thing when they're in office. And that's one of the things that I'm most concerned about is that we as a Republican Party in Virginia, I mean, you know how dysfunctional the state GOP is, that we are going to end up picking a candidate who may appeal to the base, but doesn't appeal to anybody else. And if that happens, we're going to have Governor Spanberger or Governor Stoney. We're going to have somebody who will sign any and every gun control bill that gets to their desk. And that's what really alarms me.
Yeah, I mean, the Youngkin primary situation was a whole mess in and of itself, if I remember correctly. Of course, that was also happening, when things were still pretty, it was like 2021, right? Things were still pretty messed up from COVID. To your point, I think it was a very difficult path for him to become the nominee, and it involved a lot of weird maneuvering on the part of the party. So who knows what will happen when he's out and it's time to pick the next person. It could be someone wildly different approach to politics than Young. Because the other option was, I think, like a conspiracy theorist type person who probably would have lost.
I mean, it was Amanda Chase. Let's call it, we can name names, right? It was Senator Amanda Chase, who, again, great on Second Amendment issues. But to a lot of Virginia voters, I don't know how profane I can get on the podcast, is that guano crazy, right? I mean, that's the problem. And yeah, you're right. She would have lost. She alienated members of the Republican Party. She was expelled from the Republican caucus in the Senate. Right. She appealed very much to the angry voter out there, but that was pretty much all she appealed to. I think you're right. If she had gotten the nomination, it would have been like Corey Stewart when he got the Republican nomination for Senate a couple of years before that. You know, he did very well in the primary, did abysmal in the general election. And, yep, you know, part of being...
That was the Minnesota Confederate, right?
Yeah, right. And you know, I mean, listen, I mean, part of being successful, a successful advocate or activist, is being able to think strategically and being able to act tactically, right? And politics is chess in a lot of ways. So, you know, it's not necessarily the person who makes you feel good inside that's going to be the best candidate. It's the person who has the best chance to win, who's best going to represent you once they're in office. I mean, that's it. And as long as, you know, we're not electing somebody who is a squish on Second Amendment issues or nominating someone who's a squish on Second Amendment issues, I don't mind if somebody, you know, appeals to people who don't necessarily think like me or traditionally even vote like me. In fact, I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to see how things turn out. But for now, I guess one last question on these bills that have been sent back. You sent six of these back with recommendations for the changes that could be made. I think they all basically put those bills into spaces where you're not going to have, for instance, Virginia Citizens Defense League, probably not going to be up in arms about any of these if they do get adopted. But at the same time, I don't know, are Democrats going to go along with any of those recommendations, you think, or do you expect anything else to become law out of this?
They might go along with a couple of things, but most of them are marginal. I mean, there's stuff that, again, maybe the most committed anti-gun activists care about and maybe the most committed Second Amendment activists care about. But for most voters, they're not even going to be aware of this stuff. Right. And we were talking about, aligning. I think one of these bills that Youngkin amended said, you make these changes and we'll talk. Made it illegal to intentionally remove, deface, alter, change, destroy, or obliterate the name of a manufacturer, model, serial number, or other identification on a firearm, or cause the same to happen. That was a new state law, but apparently there's, language in federal law that already does this. So Youngkin said, all right, I'm going to remove the or state law. Now the bill solely mirrors federal law, right? Like, I can see Democrats going along with that. I'm curious to see what he does with Senate Bill 225. This was the bill that Democrats passed. It would require school boards to develop this material to notify parents by text or email about how to store their firearms, right, and things of that nature. And Governor Youngkin said, if you do that, first, I want the Department of Education to come up with the material that's being sent out. I don't want it to be the local school boards. And if you're talking about, gun storage, well, let's also talk about things like sexually explicit material in schools. Let's talk about, drugs, truancy, how parents participate in disciplinary proceedings, kind of broadening out that guidance that these schools would be given. I'm curious to see if Democrats would make those changes or if they say, well, no, that goes too far. We want these local school boards. We want Fairfax in Arlington to be making these rules. We don't want the State Board of Education to be doing that because maybe they're not going to go as far as we would like. So I'm curious to see what actually happens with the Democrats. But again, the major threats to our Second Amendment rights were just vetoed completely, right? They don't have a chance to go back and try to make them a little bit better because they're dead for the session.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the bottom line. Right. Virginia law is not going to change very significantly on when it comes to guns. It's also not going back the other direction either, because one of the things that happened in 2020, besides the assault weapons ban being blocked, was that they passed, you know, a number of other policies, the big ticket stuff, universal background checks, red flag law. There were some bills that the governor vetoed that would have expanded the red flag provisions here in Virginia. But, you know, that was the, I guess, the other half of it is like they had to kind of push the envelope with some of these bills because Virginia already has a lot of the policies that gun control advocates want. I think that was another factor at play too, but it'll be really interesting to see where things head as, you know, throughout the country from here. Cause it just seems like everybody at this point you're getting, red states doing all the same policies and blue states doing all the same policies, and they're complete opposites of one another on that point. And I think that Virginia being a purple state is, you know, you're seeing those two things clash, and basically nothing is happening at this point.
You know, what is interesting, though, is that you're right. I mean, Virginia is a purple state, but rather than seeing what you would expect to be, you know, sort of purple gun control bills, right? These sort of, you know, modest minor steps, that's not what we're seeing. It speaks, I think, to your point that, you know, we're seeing this divergence. Right. And the Republicans are offering, you know, these sort of maximalist pro Second Amendment bills. The Democrats are offering sort of these maximalist anti Second Amendment bills. And these measures may get, you know, amended. They may get shot down. I mean, look, Tennessee Republicans shot down a measure that would have, in essence, eviscerated gun free zones, private property gun free zones. That was a bridge too far for Republicans, even though. And again, you know, Republicans have a supermajority. They got a Republican governor. So that's sort of the red version of what we're seeing in New Mexico and Colorado. Yeah. Where, okay, yeah, we've got the power to do this. Maybe we don't want to do this.
Yeah, we've done everything that most activists would want, most gun owners would want, but we still want to show that we're pro-gun in some way. You see this in California a lot too, right? Mm-hmm. They have every policy that you hear talked about from the gun control side, but they still want to show that they want to do something to show that, well, we're on the side of, you know, the gun control advocates. So they put forward new bills that go even further, that end up getting, you know, into constitutional trouble. And you do see that on the pro-gun side as well sometimes, because they still want to put out the signal that they are, that they're on your side, but you already have all the policies that one side wants. It gets increasingly hard to do that.
Yeah, I wrote about this. I talked about this on Cam and Company this week. Like, where do states go after they pass constitutional carry? And one of the suggestions I had, I mean, I hope that we are in a position to put this in place in Virginia one day, is, you know, the University of Wyoming Law School, Wyoming lawmakers established the Firearms Research Center a couple of years ago to sort of serve as a counter to like Johns Hopkins. And I think the University of Minnesota Law School has this anti-gun clinic. I'd love to see more red states do this. Right. We need to be incubating the next generation of Second Amendment litigators and the next generation of Second Amendment legislators. So I think that's an area actually where states that already have really good gun laws on the books could move forward and make progress. I don't think we're in a position to do it in Virginia, but there are, you know, 29 other states that are constitutional carry states that could do something like that. And hope we see more of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting thought. And yeah, potential path forward that is maybe less controversial than some of these other, like the nullification bills that you've seen out there, the NFA or something like that. But that's all for another topic. I think we'll absolutely have to have you back on the show and maybe go into some more detail about, because I think it's a good idea. Like, yeah, where do you go? Where should they go? What are the ideas out there that are, and which ones are better than others or more constitutionally grounded than others, I guess. that could be a whole nother, we could do a whole nother 45 minutes on that. So
next time, we'll do it next time.
Yes, next time, maybe on your show.
Hey, there you go. There's an idea.
Speaking of which, you know, where can people find your show and find your writing?
Yeah, you bet. BarryandArms.com is the website. You can access Barry and Arms Cam and Company right there on the homepage, but you can also just look up Barry and Arms Cam and Company on YouTube and Spotify and Rumble and all the rest. I think we're on all the major podcast platforms. We do this Monday through Thursday. And you know, it's very interview driven, for the most part, like your podcast. I don't really like it when it's just me talking to myself in the audience. I like to bring other folks on. So, yeah, if folks have not had a chance to check it out, I'd encourage them to do so. And Steve, as always, man, I appreciate the invite. I love talking with you and, hope you have a great Easter weekend.
Yeah, absolutely, man. You too. I highly recommend Cam's show. It's like this show, except Cam has been doing interviews and radio and TV for much longer than I have. So he's a bit more polished at it.
The first Cam and Company, by the way, April 16th, 2004. So we're getting awfully close to the 20th anniversary.
Wow.
I know.
It'll be a big show. I'll have to come over and watch that one.
Maybe you'll be my guest on that show.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll wait until the 16th and have you on the show then.
There you go. That's an idea. I like that. All right. Well, we're going to head over to our news update now, and we'll have to have you back on again real soon.
Anytime, man. Thanks.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the news update. I'm contributing writer Jake Fogelman, joined, as always, by Reload founder Stephen Gutowski. How are we doing this week, Steve?
I'm doing okay. It's opening day for the Phillies today. We're filming on Friday, so probably try to watch that game. What about you? How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm getting over a little bit of a cold, so if I sound a little nasally to the listeners, that's why. And opening day for the Rockies was yesterday, and they got absolutely obliterated. So no celebration. No celebration there.
You looking forward to the Rockies season?
Just call the season already. Call it off.
yeah, but otherwise, things are going pretty well. It was a bit of a slow week, but I think we still got some good stuff coming in here from the headlines. What are we talking about this week?
Yeah, so the first one has to do with some electoral politics. We got a story out of the Texas Tribune talking about GunTuber Brandon Herrera is running in a primary challenge to an incumbent GOP congressman, Tony Gonzalez, in Texas. And he actually forced that race to a runoff. And so they're sort of following the dynamics where this is the one race where you can safely say it's solely focused on gun politics, or almost solely focused on gun politics, rather. So sort of interesting as a bellwether for what that means in the upcoming races.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that race is one of the most interesting as far as gun politics go, because that was basically the whole onus for Herrera's campaign, was that Gonzalez voted in favor of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. He was one of the only House Republicans to do that. And so, you know, this is a campaign almost exclusively as backlash to that vote. And, I mean, he's forced him to a runoff, you know. Now Gonzalez, I think he got like 45% or so of that vote, and Herrera was at 20, something like that. So, you know, Gonzalez has a big lead going into this runoff, but you know, with these sorts of races, you never know, where they're going to end up in the end, if you get to that runoff stage. So, especially because I think the other candidates who drew significant portions of the vote are also basically strongly against Gonzalez. So their voters may well go to Herrera. And yeah, I mean, he's made that issue the primary part of his campaign. Obviously, they've talked about both of them have focused on other issues as well, but this has been the marquee issue in the race. And you know, I think it says a lot about where Republican politics are, certainly on guns. I think it's one of those races that you look for when you're trying to measure the impact of the gun issue. Like, are there people losing primaries based on gun votes? Are there is this a significant issue in a key race somewhere? And so here's a pretty direct, stark example of that.
Yeah, no, that to me is the most interesting part, is what kind of hold does gun politics still have? Is it enough for incumbents to actually lose their seats? So it'll be definitely something we'll be keeping an eye on as it gets closer to that runoff race. The next story we're going to talk about is an interesting one out of Wyoming. Comes to us from WyoFile, or no, actually, sorry, this was the AP, talking about the Wyoming governor signing a bunch of gun bills, including one to basically ban red flag laws in the state. But he also vetoed a gun rights bill, which would have basically eliminated the remaining sensitive places restrictions that there actually are in Wyoming, which included like school campuses, specifically for concealed carry, not open carry. But he vetoed it on the grounds of separation of powers. And he said that they should retain some semblance of local control over those select few issues. But sort of an interesting breakdown in a very otherwise very pro-gun state.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the more interesting aspect of that is than the fight over the concealed carry sensitive places or gun-free zones on, you know, on a limited basis. The more interesting bit is the red flag law ban. Like, this is something where Wyoming not only doesn't have a red flag law, but now they've made it illegal to carry out red flag style gun confiscation orders, whether they're from the federal government. Not the federal government doesn't have a red flag law or any sort of procedure like that, but it's sort of a forward looking thing to prevent red flag laws from ever being instituted in Wyoming, and also opens up local law enforcement agencies, not necessarily the officers themselves, but the agencies, to liability if they ever were involved in a gun seizure effort that fits this law. Because the law still allows for other types of gun seizure, you know, your more traditional, like if you're convicted of a crime or something of that nature. Basically, if you're a prohibited person under federal law, you would still be subject to having your guns seized with this law. It's more tailored to be about red flag ordinances. It's particularly interesting, I think, because it's not the first one. Oklahoma passed a law like this, sort of surprisingly enough, that was like 4 years ago. So Oklahoma didn't start the trend necessarily. There wasn't a big rush to do this elsewhere, but now that Wyoming's doing it, I think you might start to see more states, more of the red states, do this. This might be the next sort of red state gun policy to crop up.
Yeah, and that's certainly interesting because, you know, many of these sort of gun policies that pop up, one state it takes the experimental step, and you do sort of see these pop up in clusters and more of the deeper red states where they're safely Republican. Mm-hmm. So yeah, We'll certainly be on the lookout to see if this one might be the next after Wyoming.
And it says a lot about where red flag laws have ended up. You know, that it wasn't that long ago that Florida passed one, right?
Right.
And now they've really started to settle into that that divide that we've seen in gun policy. That, you know, there was some thought and some reason to believe that maybe this would become a more bipartisan solution to mass shootings. That's how they were sort of pitched after Parkland. It's not what they were originally pitched to do. I mean, they're really more for suicidal ideation situations like that. That's when they get used far more often than mass shootings. But this was presented as a potential policy to a sort of compromise-ish policy for addressing mass shootings. And then obviously there's been quite a lot of opposition based on the lower bar for due process that these often carry with them. That's been the real sticking point, obviously, that you've seen in most red states. And it feels as though we're at the point now where there's probably not much room left for red flag laws to grow. I mean, we saw efforts in Tennessee last year or two years ago to pass a type of red flag law that just didn't take off, even though the governor supported it. So yeah, and you know, this is another sign that there probably aren't going to be more red flag laws going forward. You know, the president, the White House announced the whole, as part of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, that bill that Gonzalez voted for, there's a bunch of money set aside to help implement red flag laws in the state level, and the White House created an office to administer that money. It's just this week, actually, but. Of course, the issue is that that's not what's keeping states from implementing red flag laws. It's not the money issue It's an opposition at the sort of principal level that a lot of Republicans and gun rights advocates don't like these laws. So it's not about funding for them that's keeping them from passing. And so, I think what Wyoming has done shows you sort of the crystallization of this, the calcification of the two sides on this issue, and red flag laws have just kind of become another one of those policies where both sides are in, they've stabilized their positions on it.
Yeah, certainly. And then the last kind of pair of stories we're going to talk about from the newsletter come from the Seattle Times and the Denver Post. Listeners may recall both Colorado and Washington at the onset of their respective legislative sessions introduced versions of sensitive places bills for gun carry.
And you both read about that, right?
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting because it was the first time you saw a non-formerly May issue state, so long-time shall issue state, sort of take the same, a similar tack to what a lot of the other May issue states did following the Bruin decision, where they sort of retaliated by making, okay, we'll grant permits, but we're going to make them pretty much useless in most of the state. And so you saw them introduce bills to do something similar. Colorado's was much more similar to, for example, California's sensitive place bill, but they both introduced them. And they've both since been substantially watered down. So in the case of Washington, it was the provision that would have made it apply to concealed carry permit holders was completely stripped. So now it's just an open carry ban, essentially, in the listed sensitive places. And then Colorado's bill, which made it out of committee, but hasn't been made it to law yet, just whittled down the list of sensitive places to those that were specifically stated by Justice Clarence Thomas in the Bruin decision. He says, you know, nothing in this decision shall cast doubt on the ability to, you know, restrict guns in longstanding sensitive places like polling places and schools and that sort of thing. So government buildings, polling places, schools are what's left in Colorado's bill after they really swung for the fences to try to do originally what California did.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think it speaks to this dynamic I was talking about a little bit with Cam, you know, as part of this sort of caveat to what we saw in Virginia, where the two sides have really gone to opposite ends. And you saw the Virginia Democrats on board with a whole list of very aggressive gun control policies, even the moderate ones or ones in swing districts or whatever you want to say, call them. They're all on board. But part of the reason for that, perhaps, is that they know that a Republican governor is likely to veto a lot of these bills, at least the most aggressive ones. And of course, he did. That's what we talked about. But in Washington and Colorado, they don't have that same luxury, right? This is often a quirk of politics where politicians are often, especially opposition politicians, are much more comfortable with voting for aggressive policies if they are sure they're not going to actually make it into law and they won't have to deal with the fallout of them from their constituents. And so it seems like that's perhaps the effect that's going on here in Colorado and Washington. I mean, when you're talking about these sorts of sensitive places, expansions, like the really wide berth where you're making, I mean, California has effectively made concealed carry illegal. I mean, there just wasn't anywhere you could really take your gun legally, even with a permit. And so when you're getting to that level, you're really having a very significant impact on the day-to-day lives of people in your district who are going to turn out to vote or are going to be much more likely to turn out to vote if you do something like that. And it feels like that's maybe what's happening here.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. There was at least in Colorado, I can speak to this one because I kind of watched this debate unfold. It was a moderate swing district, sort of semi-rural district Democrat that headed the committee that heard this bill. And he was very clearly uncomfortable with advancing this bill as it was introduced, because obviously he heard from plenty of constituents. And concealed carry, it's worth noting, licensed concealed carry is relatively uncontroversial as gun policies go. It's not something like hardware bans or some of these other things where people are very far apart in what they want to see happen. Concealed carry, I think we've, at least in the long-time shall issue states, there's sort of an equilibrium where people say, oh, you get a permit, you go through training or whatever. So it's less controversial. And so I think it's a much tougher, as you point out, for swing district lawmakers to do something that's going to crack down on those people when they know that if they do, there's a good chance it's going to make it into law and they're going to hear from it from their constituents. So
yeah. Yeah, but it is fascinating to see this reversal of fortune for these Bruin response bills. Because it was really interesting. This was one of the reasons why it was interesting, right? To see these states move forward with some of these new restrictions, because a lot of their constituents presumably already have permits and have been carrying for years, and they have a significant impact. Where the lawmakers in the former May issue states, right, the ones that were affected by the Bruin ruling, had their laws found unconstitutional. Essentially, they had to rewrite them and start allowing people to get permits. They've really kind of managed to keep essentially the status quo for the vast majority of gun owners, because before they couldn't get permits. Now they can get permits, but they can't carry anywhere, really. And so that hasn't changed a lot in the day-to-day lives of those people. They might, I mean, not that they aren't necessarily going to be motivated to vote on that, but it's a bit different when you're taking something that was the status quo and shaking it up this way. I think that's harder to do.
Yeah, absolutely. But getting into some of the pieces we wrote this week, you had an interesting write-up of some new polling on President Biden and the way voters perceive his gun policy performance so far. And it's actually down pretty substantially from the last time this was polled, if you want to tell us some of those results.
Yeah, his approval is down 7 points in a month. And now, you know, look, this is one poll. So just to be clear, like this, you can't take too much in the individual points that he moves in these polls. He's been around the low 30% in this poll. This is a YouGov Economist poll, but also in the AP. And there have been a number of polls that have found his approval rating on guns in particular to be quite low, in the around the 30%. This one's at 29%. So it matches. He hasn't been that low in this poll since July of last year, which is, significant. And it also, you know, not just that his approval rating is down, it's also, I mean, there's a number of things about this poll I think make it noteworthy, right? It's, his numbers are way down, but also they are among the worst performance that on any issue. He's actually the second worst performance in that poll to immigration. So more Americans approve of how he's handled the economy or inflation or things like that than they do of how he's handled guns. His approval on guns is well below his overall approval rating. I think it's like 9 or 10 points below his overall approval rating, which is not very good, as I think people already have a good understanding of by this point. His approval ratings are quite bad generally, but this, they're particularly bad on this issue. And then also the, guns was not the top issue. That was still inflation in this poll, but it was, I think, about 8% had it as their most important issue, which puts it right somewhere in the middle of the pack. You know, it's not a low tier issue for most people. You know, it's above even things like abortion or civil rights, or there's a number of common big ticket issues where guns are polling above that. And so I think it speaks to the challenge that he has if he wants to win re-election, you know, and also it's an indication that what he's tried to do so far has not persuaded most people, the vast majority of people, that he's taking the right path. I think that it's not just about gun owners being upset with him. Although, you know, if you look at the breakdown in the various subgroups, you know, certainly Republicans and conservatives have the lowest approval on this issue of anyone. Now they're going to have most of these issues. You're going to see a huge disconnect between conservatives and liberals and Republicans and Democrats, right? This is how polling on politicians works now. If you look at Trump's numbers, you'll see the same thing. Also, he's not doing well with independents, which is another big problem. And he's not doing that well with Democrats, right? This is one of the big things that's haunted him for a while now, is that Yeah, he's got, I think, is 55% of Democrats approved of how he's handled guns. That's not very good. Traditionally, like usually, I think you should see your own party approving of you as an incumbent president at a much higher rate than that. You know, if you look at, for instance, who they're going to vote for, he's getting like 85% of Democrats or higher, just like Trump is getting at this point, around that percentage as well of Republicans. And so if you've got like 30% of your base who says they might vote for you, but they don't like how you handle guns. And then almost nobody in the Republican Party likes how you handle guns. That's how you get an approval rating this low.
Yeah, no, it sort of speaks to how he's sort of caught between a rock and a hard place on gun policy, because he hasn't had the numbers in Congress to get like the hardware bans, the big ticket items that the Democratic base really wants done.
Right.
But he's done little piecemeal things like ATF regulations that we've covered extensively. He launches an Office of Gun Violence Prevention, sort of more, not that they're not big deals, but they're more niche issues that I don't think your normie voter who's not super plugged into this stuff even recognizes. But at the same time, it pisses off the people that do know. They do see this as big overstepping on gun policy if you're a conservative or a gun rights type of voter. So you're not satisfying the people that that would otherwise support you in your endeavors on gun policy. But you're also alienating the folks that don't want to see you do anything at all in the restrictive direction on guns. And I think that probably speaks to what you're seeing in these numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's exactly what's happening. You know, most of the big items that he's done that have a real impact are not things that the average Democrat or the average gun control supporter understands or knows about. Most of them don't know what a pistol brace is. Right. But people who own pistol braces sure know what they are and don't like that they've been, in a lot of cases that they've been turned into felons, essentially, because most people did not comply with the ATF's reclassification of those devices. And so you have there's a disconnect with how much that's going to impact, you know, people's approval of your handling of the issue. Because people who might like the idea of more gun restrictions, or who do like the idea of more gun restrictions, might not know that this thing happened. Whereas people who don't like the policy, they definitely know. And it's dragging, certainly would be dragging down Biden's numbers with them. I also think that there's beyond that stuff, which we've talked a lot about, right, over the last couple of years here. You also have the effect of crime and mass shootings on all this, because those are the things that I think the general public, with the way a lot of media cover the guns, that's what they think of most when they asked about guns. You know, unless you're a gun owner yourself, that's probably where your mind goes to. And the problem for Biden is, while he may have, he got a gun control bill passed, as we just talked about with the situation with Gonzalez and Herrera. But one, like, I don't think moderates or people who aren't super plugged into the issue are looking at this favorably either, because he hasn't really touted that. He's still focused on things he wants to do, like the assault weapons ban. That's still the primary thing he talks about in the State of the Union or any public message he's putting out about guns, which is something he didn't accomplish. And that is highly controversial, too. But also, he doesn't really highlight in those spaces, you know, the State of the Union, doesn't focus on the things he accomplished that maybe would appeal to more moderate people who aren't high info on the issue. And then he also has the problem, as I said before, with crime, because the murder rate went way up under his administration. Now, whether that's a result of his policies or the pandemic, whatever you want to pin it on, murder rate went way up. Mass shootings have continued to be at the top of mind. We actually haven't seen any that fit the gun violence archive, or sorry, the violence project's definition. The gun violence archive, obviously much lower definition. And even there's been a severe decline in mass shootings in that count too. So this year has done, lately things have been getting better on the issue, but and the murder rate went way down last year in 2023, a huge decline in the murder rate, but people tend to notice those things less than the big increases. It's very similar to the inflation problem, right. I think, that he's facing, where it's like people noticed when the murder rate went way up, right? That was top of mind for everyone for a long time. And it was a lot of media attention on that, understandably so. Same thing with inflation. People really noticed when the prices started going up and kept going up and up and up. And now inflation has cooled down and the murder rate has come back down, but they're both still worse than they were. For one, you know, the murder rate has come back down, but it's not quite, we're not back at, you know, 2015, you know, mid 2010s levels where it was, you know, near historic lows. We're probably going, it seems like we're on the trend to get back there, but I think the increase sticks in people's mind and the improvements haven't been good enough to sway a lot of your average voters on, you know, how Biden has handled the issues. Does that, yeah. That, no. Hopefully that makes sense.
No, I think that's interesting, especially the point about him not, because you're right, he doesn't really tout what he does, what he's done on guns much. It's always, we need to ban assault weapons, we need to ban magazines. So,
and it's always things that he hasn't done that he wants Congress to do. And they're not going to get done before the election either.
Right. And that reinforces in voters' minds that it hasn't been done yet, hasn't accomplished it yet. If you're someone that supports those policies, it reinforces in their minds that that's, haven't done it yet.
If you're someone who doesn't support them, you know, obviously him saying he wants to ban your guns all the time is not going to make you approve of him very much.
Yeah, that's a good point for sure.
So I think that's the dynamic at play.
Yeah. And we'll certainly stay on top of it as we get closer to election season, because this will obviously be an interesting issue to watch. But getting into the final story we want to talk about, we have another sort of bad news ruling for the gun industry in terms of Mexico's repeated attempts to hold them criminally liable for a lot of the gun trafficking that goes on through the southern border. So this case is about a particular set of gun businesses in Arizona. Mexico sued them as well as that other suit where they sued, you know, Smith & Wesson, Colt, Glock, all the big major U.S. manufacturers. So this is a separate lawsuit. And we now have a new ruling from a federal judge who said that the suit can go forward and that the PLCAA, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which generally shields gun businesses from lawsuits like these, she said that that's not going to apply this time and that this can actually proceed to trial. So rough news for the gun industry.
Well, on a couple of like these are typical of these kinds of suits. They made a bunch of claims, right? Including like a RICO claim or something in there. And the judge dismissed a number of them. But the key point, as you mentioned there, is that the judge let some of those claims go through. And basically, they were at the stage of the case where it's like, you have to put forward a claim that could plausibly fall into one of the exceptions to the PLCAA. And you know, 'cause the PLCAA is a liability protection law, but it has some exceptions, including for violations of state law, right? If you broke the law in some way as a gun dealer or gun business, then you don't benefit from those protections. Like for instance, if you knowingly sold guns to criminals, then you would not be protected by the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act when somebody sues you for those sales. Now, and that's part of what Mexico is claiming, that basically these gun dealers in Arizona ignored red flags and sold guns to, you know, people who ended up taking them back to Mexico and committing crimes with them. Now, you know, it's one of those things where they're still going to have to prove these claims. Yep. That's not what happened in this part of the case, right? They're just, the judge is just saying you can go forward with these claims and this case can actually proceed. It's not going to get thrown out at this early stage. And so they're still going to have to prove any of these claims that they're making. But it is obviously something where the gun dealers in the industry would have wanted the case tossed at this point. They don't think that they had, you know, a meritorious claim to begin with, that these are the way that they've argued this case is not based on any sort of reasonable interpretation of the PLCAA. And so that's what the setback is for the industry and a win for Mexico and the gun control advocates that are actually driving these lawsuits. Like they're working with American gun control advocates who came from Brady and elsewhere. And so it's a whole coordinated effort at this point. But But yeah, I mean, that's they've certainly gotten to a point where they can now get discovery, I believe, in the case. And
yep.
And it's going to be a big burden for the defendants. And so it's going to be a continued thorn in the side for the gun industry moving forward on these claims that are, you know, that certainly the gun industry thinks are frivolous, at the very least, you know, basically trying to blame Mexican cartel violence on American gun companies without any actual evidence that they that there's been some sort of knowing trafficking between American gun companies and Mexican cartels. There's, if there were evidence of that, we would all know. We would all very much know about it. I mean, obviously, we all remember Fast and Furious, which was when the ATF decided to allow trafficking to Mexico in a very botched attempt to trace the path of guns down there. And that led to a lot of carnage and fallout within the agency. It was a huge scandal, obviously. But we don't have, Mexico is not presenting any sort of, you know, caught red-handed sort of evidence here so far. I guess we'll see where the case goes, but I think that was one of the big problems the industry had with this sort of lawsuit is like, it's, you're not supposed to be able to get around the PLCAA if you don't have any real claim, really evidence to back your claims. And I guess the judge disagreed in this case and is willing to let the case proceed forward a little further.
Yeah, certainly. We'll have to keep on top of it now because you've seen it twice now, two separate lawsuits that Mexico mm-hmm. succeeded in getting past this early stage. And, that, you know, like you said, they still have to prove their claims, but it may. I wrote an analysis piece about it when the other lawsuit was allowed to advance. And it may not even matter if they prove their claims because
right.
lawsuits take a lot of time, a lot of money. You can get discovery and you can, if you maybe perhaps find some unsavory or embarrassing information in discovery, you can publicize that and wage yep. a PR campaign against these businesses. So.
Yeah, and that was the whole concept of the PLCA. This was one of the big complaints that the industry had back in the 90s when these types of lawsuits first started, which was that they're not really intended to be successful on the merits. They're more intended to tie up gun companies in court, make them pay for legal fees, and then try to get access to their internal communications so that they could publicize those rather than actually win the case. So yeah, that's the dynamic here. That's the complaint. And that's why the making it through this early stage could matter, even if they don't win on the merits in the end.
Certainly. But we'll stay on top of it for sure as it moves forward, because this is a sort of a first of its kind strategy from another country.
Yeah, certainly.
But I think you wanted to talk about some interesting new developments in the firearms market, a new particular model of firearm, and how it's sort of indicative of a broader trend that we've seen in the gun industry lately with new releases and sort of maybe basically beta testing them with the first buyers of the firearms.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we talked about the Daniel Defense H9 a couple of weeks ago on the show, right, when it first came out. And I was thinking of buying one, or it looked exciting, at least. There's a lot of hype around the gun to begin with. And, I mean, I haven't been able to find one in my local shop yet, so I haven't actually shot it. I didn't get to shoot it when I was at SHOT Show. I didn't get to do range day this year. I did handle it briefly on the floor, where the trigger actually felt really heavy, to be honest. I like the concept of the, it's a bit different from all the other guns. A lot of Glock copies in the world, and they have their merits. They all do, right? But, that was one of the big hype points of the H9 and has been actually for years, even before Daniel Defense got a hold of it. I shot the original H9 and actually wasn't super impressed with it, but it had a lot of hype when it first came out. Then that company went out of business and Daniel Defense bought off the design, and now they've put out their own version of it, and it's gotten, that hype came right back. But now it seems to have derailed quite a bit. In recent weeks, you're seeing people who are getting actual production models and having really significant issues with them. Things like keyholing, where essentially the the rifling is not actually biting into the bullet as it travels down the barrel, and the bullet starts to flip end over end and keyhole, which is a huge problem. It's not going to shoot accurately if that's happening. I've seen several videos where people have experienced that issue. There've been a number of issues with malfunctions, failure to feed, failure to eject. A lot of problems with the gun early on, to the point where now it feels like, like you mentioned, there's sort of another example of a big gun release where the early adopters are almost more like beta testers. You've seen this over and over and over again in the gun industry of the last 5 to 10 years. I mean, I've experienced it myself. I bought an early run of the SIG P365 when that first came out. And it had big issues when it first came out. It had light primer strikes was my issue on my gun. And there were issues like that on a lot of guns. Primer drag was an issue for when that, and you could go back to the Smith & Wesson M&P Shield had problems when it first came out. The Springfield XDS had issues, and they had, a number of these were recalled or service bulletined or whatever. The 320, right? The P320 had drop safety issues when it first came out. The trigger was too heavy on the regular models and could fire if dropped at the wrong angle because of the internal design. Didn't account for that, and they had to do some sort of service bulletin thing for that as well. And it's just something that seems super common now with the way that the industry is putting out these guns. I mean, I don't think that there's necessarily huge safety implications with most of these problems, other than maybe that drop safety one. And the P320 still has issues, it seems like. There's an ongoing lawsuit. Now, I'm always pretty skeptical of claims where guns fired by themselves. And so it's hard to say for sure exactly what's going on there. But they clearly did have problems with it. You could see it in the military version of the 320, M18 or whatever it's called, where they made a number of changes to that gun after it was issued. Where you can physically look at the guns before certain run and then after a certain run at the factory, and there are clear changes, and it seems to be a significant problem in the industry. I would say, it's just not something that should be continuing to happen. Like, these guns are getting released in a stage where they're not finished. Now, I do eventually, as you can tell from the guns that I listed there, they seem to work out these kinks over time. The 365 is obviously one of the most popular guns in existence at this point, and they eventually fix the problems with it. Same thing for the Shield or the XDS or whatever. And some of the issues were more minor than other issues. And it's entirely possible that the H9 will also get to the point in a year or two where it is a world-class firearm that's worth especially the premium that they put on it. But I'm pretty tired of seeing this happen over and over again. It just doesn't seem acceptable that these companies keep doing this. And the gun media as well. I bought into the hype around the H9 and around the 365 when they first released. And even though I should have known, right, I should know better at this point. Don't get too bought into the early hype of the first release videos that get flooded out there. And everyone's talking about how great the gun is or how cool it is. Wait a while. Don't go out and buy those guns. It's like the video game industry, right? The pre-orders for video games, and they're releasing them half finished with all kinds of bugs. And maybe they get fixed in the long run. The No Man's Sky would be a good example, right? Of a game that came out unfinished and then eventually they fixed that and it became a great game. But more often than not, you're getting games that just get Anthem, right? I don't know how much crossover you have with gamers here, but is the H9 the Anthem of guns? I don't know. Is it going to get fixed? Are they going to address these problems? Maybe. They don't even have like the mounting plates for optics yet. They're selling you a $1,300 gun. That my understanding from at least what I've seen in reviews is they're selling you a gun. It has an optic cutout, but they don't have the mounting plates for it. And so you can't actually put an optic on this gun unless you get your own mounting plates. And it's like, that's another sign that this gun just wasn't fully finished when they weren't really ready to release this when they did. And it's a problem. It's a huge problem. They shouldn't be doing this. Shouldn't be a common thing that you see in the industry. And it is from the biggest companies. And I don't know. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Certainly a less than ideal trend for especially for a tool that a lot of people are counting on for their self-defense. So
yeah, that 365. I mean, I was going to carry that and then I couldn't get it to reliably function. So I never carried it ever. I still have that gun too, because I also don't want to. I mean, I think I fixed the issues because eventually I got a new striker assembly for it. And I think it was a spring issue. Like the springs weren't stiff enough or whatever. I don't know. You know, it just didn't go bang every time you pull the trigger. And that's a huge problem if you want to carry it for self-defense.
Yeah, that's but, for sure.
It can be hard, too, to tell the difference here because, you know, you're talking about products sometimes where you've got tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands out the door. And so social media makes it really easy to pick out a single issue that one person has and explode that into the whole run being a problem. The 320 is another example that like there's a lot of 320s out there. And so if some of them have issues, does that mean that they're all defective? I don't know. But it seems to be a real trend. These hyped up guns that come out when they first come out, that they have issues. I had issues with the X Macro and that. Not as nearly as significant as some of these other guns. But you know, like the optic died almost immediately, right? The battery in that, like after a couple of weeks, some of this stuff is going to be break-in period stuff. Like my 320 X5 had issues going into battery at first. But it wore in over a couple hundred rounds. The X Macro had issues with the magazines, where if you fully loaded that magazine, which was the point of buying that gun, right, the extra capacity, it wouldn't strip the first round off the magazine if you had a full magazine and one in the chamber, because the magazine springs were too stiff. That got better eventually too, right? And so some of these things can be wear-in issues, but it doesn't seem like that's what's going on with the H9. And it doesn't seem like that wasn't the issue with the 365, the first couple runs of that gun. That wasn't the issue with these other, you know, the 320's trigger being too heavy, physically heavy for the drop safety mechanism they have built in. Some things can be wear-in issues, but it seems like there's a trend where these newer guns, especially the really highly hyped up ones, are being released before they're really thoroughly finished being refined. And it's a huge issue to me.
Absolutely. And as we're kind of coming up on time here, I know we also want to give the listeners an update about some changes that are potentially coming to the podcast and how we release it. You want to let the folks know how things are going to be different moving forward.
Yeah, I think one of the things we want to improve in the future here is the timeliness of these news updates and the clips that we put on YouTube, things like that, because, you know, we're making the podcast as one unit right now. And that means, you know, we're filming the news update on Friday, but people aren't getting it at the earliest until Sunday with the members. Reload members get it obviously a day early, and then everybody else gets it Monday, and maybe we're able to make, you know, we have limited resources here at the Reload, so we're not making, you know, our clips might not come out until a little bit after the full podcast gets released. So we're just trying to, one of the things we want to do is speed up that whole process. And I think the best way to accomplish it, plus the podcasts tends to, if I have a really good interview or we have really good news stories to talk about, like this week, it tends to run pretty long. We can get up to like an hour and a half, and that's a bit long, I think, for people to be able to listen to the entire thing. And so it makes more sense to split these into two, I think. We're going to keep the interview podcast the same way it is. And it'll be out on Sundays for members. You know, they'll get it a day early, and Monday for everybody else. The news update, we're going to move that to Fridays as its own separate podcast. And that'll be a way for us to get these news updates out a little bit faster for you guys, so that they're not stale by the time you're listening to it. And it gives us a little more breathing room to make the podcasts, do the interview, especially as long as makes sense, you know. And so that's the change I think we're going to implement starting next week. So, you know, if anybody has, especially if you're a Reload member and you have any concerns about this change, just let me know, drop me an email, respond to your Sunday newsletter with any thoughts you have on it. But I think that'll work out a little bit better for us. We're just going to publish them through the same process that we do with the podcast now. It'll be, you know, out on your favorite podcasting app. It'll go up immediately. Members will still have early access to the interview podcast, but the news update section, we want to get that out as quickly as possible. And so, you know, if people have an issue with that change, just let me know and I'll try to work through it or figure out a solution. But that's the plan for now, and I think that'll work out best for everybody. And Jake will be hosting the news update, since he hosts our news update on the full podcast anyway, right? You looking forward to that, Jake?
Yeah, host duties. Yeah.
I think it'll be good. But yeah, that's all we got for this week. Look for that change coming next week. Of course, if you want to get the interview podcast early, you can, of course, sign up for our membership. I've mixed up the call outs here. If you want to get our free newsletter, you can sign up for that at the website. And you'll get, you know, keep up to date with what's going on with Guns in America every week on Friday. But if you want extra access, if you want more content, you want those analysis pieces that are behind our member only section, then you're going to have to buy a membership, and you will, of course, also get this podcast a day early and the opportunity to appear on the show in a member segment, which we will absolutely still be keeping around. I believe we'll put that probably in the interview podcast. But yeah, make no mistake, we're going to still have on voices from our community. I think the Reload subscribers are some of the most interesting people out there. So we're absolutely going to keep interviewing you guys. But you can head over to our website and pick up a membership today if you want any of those perks. But that's all we've got for this week. We will see you guys again real soon.